Even if sentience goes further down than, you know, vertebrates, for instance, you do reach a point where it does seem to just not matter. Like, even though they are technically sentient, like, they don't have the kind of complex experiences. Like, if you think that, you know, like sponges have like this faint, dim awareness, like, you know, just like a half remembered dream or something, it's like, I don't think there's any problem with like whatever you do to sponges. Like, I just, even if they are technically sentient, they're just so, like, it's just such a low degree of moral salience that I don't really care about sponges, even if they do turn out to be sentient. Cause I know it can't possibly be like what it's like for you or me or a dog or a chicken.
Well, I'd like to come back to that in a moment as well, because I think it links to another topic that you've done a lot of thinking on. But I guess there's, before we come back to this idea about grading sentience or if there's a, you know, minimal levels of it, there's another challenge to sentientism. One is the anthropocentric thing that says, look, only humans matter, right? And often, whether it's stated or not, that is the sort of default mode of operation of modern humanity, unfortunately. There's another challenge to sentientism, which is, hold on, you're not going far enough, right? You're discriminating against the non-sentient stuff. So sentientism, again, it doesn't tell you which things are sentient. It just says take a naturalistic approach to working it out, right? So it doesn't set a boundary. It doesn't list species. It doesn't say anything about plant sentience, for example. It just says whatever sentience is and wherever it is, it matters. That's it. So, but then use a naturalistic approach. But if we assume, for example, you know, plants or aren't sentient, you can go into biocentrism, which says all living things matter regardless of sentience. Or you can go even further than that into ecocentrism and say, look, ecosystems, rocks, rivers, trees, the planet as Gaia, habitats, you know, those things matter intrinsically, independent of any sentience as well. What's your thought about going beyond sentience and thinking about, you know, bio or ecocentrism as a even more generous moral scope?
I mean, I'm pretty sure that, I mean, I'm certain that sentience matters, but then when it comes to some of this other stuff, I'm like less certain about it, but I don't think it's totally crazy to say that, you know, the sort of like complexity of life is valuable in and of itself, regardless of whether or not, you know, something like panpsychism is true. So if you can even imagine panpsychism not being true, if you can imagine that.
This is where I wanted to go.
if you can even conceive of such a thing, I still kind of think,
because in a way under a panpsychist, well, we can come back to that in a minute, but in a way under a panpsychist view, there's no such thing as anything that isn't conscious. Therefore, you sort of, you know, ecocentrism and, you know, consciousnessism all collapse together in a way.
Well, I mean, strictly speaking, most things are not conscious on panpsychism. So it doesn't mean that everything is conscious, but I still think that maybe living systems have intrinsic value regardless of whether or not they're sentient. I'm certainly sympathetic to the view that states of consciousness are the only intrinsically valuable things in nature. But I, you know, if you think about like two planets, you know, and one of them is just like a dust bowl, and the other one is just teeming with like life. It's like this really complex rainforest, but there's nothing sentient like anywhere. I do have like this sort of weak intuition that like, yeah, that one is more valuable than this one, even though neither involve any sentience. And I think some people would just reject that. They would say, no, who cares? Like if there's no sentient beings to observe the beauty or like to like flourish in that system, then it just doesn't matter. And I don't know. I don't feel that way. I have no intention of like spending a lot of time in like national parks or anything, but I'm so glad they're there. You know, like, I don't know. I just think that this kind of stuff is valuable just in itself, I think.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And I share that intuition, although I would probably lay out the argument you just did, which is the differences between those two planets is the way you're thinking about them in your sentient mind. And intrinsically, you know, if there's nothing there to experience it, then there really is no difference. But I still feel that pull. It feels odd to us. And I think I'd share a rich appreciation of the value of the ecosystems and biosphere, but I do that in an instrumental way that can still be quite rich, right? So the reason I care about the environment we all share is because of all the sextillion sentient beings that live on this planet. That's the reason I care about this planet and not so much about, you know, Venus or Mars or somewhere else, right? It's because of the impact on the sentient beings. But I guess my frustration again is more about I'm more worried about the exclusion of sentient beings than I am the inclusion of other stuff. And my frustration with most bio or ecocentrists is that a logical, consistent bio or ecocentrist would also care about all sentient beings as well, because they're part of the biosphere and they're part of the ecosphere. But most bio and ecocentrists seem to have conveniently disregarded non-human sentient animals from practical moral consideration. And that gives the lie to a lot of ecocentrism and a lot of environmentalism is really just another veneer on an anthropocentric worldview. So my stance is, you know, I don't mind if you want to be more generous and go further, but firstly, you've got to recognize and morally consider all sentient beings. And I'd also argue that even if you do care about plants and rocks and rivers and ecosystems in their own right intrinsically, surely the capacity to experience suffering still gives you some other additional reason to care about that entity morally. But so I'm sort of open-minded, but I still want to keep this, you know, just don't exclude the sentient beings.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've heard you say this, like, you know, several times. I guess I just don't have the same experience with environmentalists, not because I've had different experiences with them, but because I've had no experiences with them, because I don't think I talk to them very often, but it sounds like you have. And yeah, I mean, if this is a prevalent view, then yeah, I mean, that's just crazy to care more about, you know, the ecosystem than you care about sentient beings. Like, obviously the main reason to care about the ecosystem is the sentient beings who live in the ecosystem. Like, that's the main reason you would care about it. And then maybe there's this additional thing that, oh, it's just valuable in and of itself, but that doesn't compare to the billions of humans that are living here. Like, it just doesn't compare. So even if there is this, like, that things that morally matter beyond sentience, states of consciousness, then I just don't think they're nearly as important as, like, states of consciousness, you know, even if they're, so I think there can just be a, there can still be like a hierarchy, even if you think there are multiple things of intrinsic value, just like humans are more important than chickens, you know, like if you have to hit a human or if your car is out of control and you can either hit a human or a chicken, you got to hit the chicken. Like, it's a no brainer. Like, no, I can't think of, I don't spend a lot of time talking to vegans or environmentalists or anything, but I would hope that everyone would agree with that. You know, I don't know. Do you think that they would?
I think most would. And I think that's one of the other things that sentientism is neutral on. It doesn't say every sentient being should be given exactly equal moral consideration. It just says they all should be given moral consideration. So some people will, in theory, push for a more egalitarian approach that says as soon as something is minimally sentient, it counts. But I think even they, you know, in that thought experiment would have to acknowledge that, you know, if the choice is a spider or a chicken or a human, there's a clear choice there, even if theoretically they'd like to be more egalitarian. I think others will look at sentience as a really diverse, whether it's a class of information processing or something else, they'll see the diversity of it and recognize that, you know, it may therefore make sense to recognize different degrees of sentience, maybe in some sort of really complex multidimensional way. And therefore you could grade moral consideration in different ways as well. As you were hinting at earlier on, you know, with the super simplest sentient beings, it might have some absolutely minimal level of sentience, but does it have the same, should we give it the same moral weight? So a lot of that stuff, sentientism is, again, conveniently neutral on and sort of leaves it open for debate. But I think most people intuitively would recognize there's, it makes sense to have some space for grading in there to some degree. And there's some cautionary points there. One is because, you know, it is another easy way for us humans to put ourselves at the top of some imagined pyramid and say we're the most sentient, everything else matters less. And you can see where that leads. So some people follow that path. And we should be skeptical of that because us humans are good at inventing hierarchies that we're at the top of. But I think there's also some completely biological, naturalistic ways of recognizing that in some senses, I'm sure we as humans do have a richness of sentient experience that maybe isn't available to some non-human animals. But that doesn't mean the same isn't true the other way around. You know, there are certain experiences that aren't available to us. And I think it's also possible, maybe even likely, that some of the simpler sentient beings have a visceral intensity of experience that might be just as serious as ours. You know, I think ultimately that's why sentience evolved, is because it was go towards good stuff, go away from bad stuff. And that could be pretty intense. So just because a being might have less neurons than us, maybe has a narrower range of sentient experiences, they could be just as viscerally intense. So we've got to be, I think we should be very careful and prudent about that. But I, you know, personally, I'd certainly recognize some sort of sense of grading and weighting of moral consideration there too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there has to be some kind of grading. But I remember Richard Dawkins making this point where he said that maybe intelligence kind of diminishes the need to have really intense pain and pleasure.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you can experience pain that you couldn't if you were less intelligent. Like, you have to have a certain level of intelligence to, you know, be betrayed in like a really complex way, because you need like a complex social system or to have like betrayal in the kind of ways that humans can be betrayed, but you can't be betrayed in that same way if you're a non-human animal. But at the same time, you know, physical pain and pleasure might not be as intense in some ways, because you don't need that much of an incentive, because you can kind of see other reasons why you shouldn't do that thing. So it might be the case that less intelligent animals, you know, non-human animals, are like, they experience pain more intensely than we do, because they need the stronger prodding, because they're not like reflecting or thinking about the other reasons why they shouldn't do these maladaptive things. So it's totally possible that non-human animals have like a worse experience of physical pain than we do.
Yeah, I think that's where I think this need for prudence comes from. One of my previous guests talked about the thoughts of experiment of, you know, a chimpanzee going to the dentist. You know, we probably feel exactly the same physical experiences, but I can mitigate that because I know I'm there. I know I'm being helped. I know there's a benefit the other side of it. Whereas for a chimpanzee who isn't able to understand the context, even if the physical sensations are identical, the nature of the experience will just be viscerally horrific.
Right.
So I think that's another example. Maybe we can, in some senses, evolutionary, don't need such an intense experience because we have rationality or other things going on. But we've also got ways we can mitigate our own suffering psychologically or through other means that just aren't available to non-human animals. So,
if you leave the gym after a really good workout and you're kind of sore, like, that feels good in a way, but if you just woke up one day and you felt like that for no reason, you'd be like, I need to go to the doctor. Like, if just having some reason, you know, why you're going through that suffering, you know, it makes the suffering a lot more endurable, you know, or maybe not even have that negative of a valence at all.
Yeah. We've talked about this idea of going beyond sentience or not, and we've talked about this idea of grading sentience. One of the topics I'm really interested in discussing with you that sentientism itself is neutral on is, okay, what actually is sentience? So there are sentientists who have a panpsychist view. There are sentientists who have a illusionist view. There are sentientists who have a sort of functional naturalist, sort of materialist view. There's all sorts of philosophies of mind about what sentience and also consciousness is. But I was interested to explore that with you, partly to tease out whether it has an implication for our ethical scope. So some people will say, okay, if we have a sentientist scope, and if they think of sentience and consciousness as essentially equivalent, and then you have a much more expansive view of the prevalence of consciousness in the universe, you know, in the silliest terms, does an electron feel pain, right? Do we have to radically change our ethics? And maybe does it completely destroy our ethics? So that's one way of asking the question. But I'm interested in whether you think of sentience and consciousness as the same thing or distinct concepts, and how do your views about the philosophy of mind play back into this concern for suffering, flourishing, and sentience?
Yeah. Now, I think that your views in philosophy of mind will end up having ethical implications, most likely. And I used to kind of resist that with panpsychism. Like, so I do think sentience is a bit more prevalent in the natural world than most people do. But I used to try to resist the ethical implications, but I think it does have ethical implications, but they're mostly positive. I don't think it like destroys our ethics, even though it is a totally reasonable question to say, well, okay, you think sentience is one of the main things that matters, if not the only thing that matters morally, and you think sentience is everywhere. So, I mean, doesn't that seem to diminish, our concern for like each other or non-human animals if everything is conscious? Well, I mean, panpsychists don't believe that everything is conscious. Like, I don't think that my table is conscious or my chair is conscious. So all the things that you kind of pre-reflectively think are not conscious are probably not conscious on panpsychism. But there are still, you know, many, many more things that are conscious. Like, most organisms probably are conscious. So, you know, you might say, well, isn't even a vegan diet indefensible if you're a panpsychist? But as you already mentioned, if you're just trying to minimize like the number of plants that are killed, if you think there's some faint sentience there, so it's not morally neutral to eat plants, then becoming a vegan is still the better way to minimize that because factory farmed animals eat quite a lot of plants. And like, that's what most of the farmland actually goes to, if I'm not mistaken, is like the plants that feed the factory farmed animals, right? Like two thirds of it.
And the feed conversion ratios vary a lot by species, but on average, a good ballpark is 10 times. So you need to put 10 times the amount of plants in terms of, you know, calories or protein into an animal to get that same amount out. I don't think it's where most of the food goes through to, but for some food types, it is more than half. So I think for soy, for example, 78% of it goes to animal feed. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So even if you were just trying to, minimize the number of sentient beings you consume, or like the damage that you're doing to the world, then you would still obviously go vegan. And that's not even invoking all the other reasons that you should go vegan, but it's unavoidable. Okay. Like, it don't use panpsychism as an excuse to not go vegan. Yeah. It's like that. It can't be done. I'm sorry, but,
it's inescapable.
So with panpsychism, I think it might have some other, ethical implications as well, where, so some people are neo-Cartesians. Obviously, neo-Cartesianism is crazy regardless of your views of philosophy of mind. Just the idea that non-human animals don't have any experiences and like you can just do whatever you want to them because they're just mechanisms. That's obviously incorrect and also very morally perverse. But panpsychism does basically ensure that you can't possibly hold that view. So I do still hear sometimes a weak form of neo-Cartesianism, like something that's pretty common. Is the idea that fish can't feel pain. Like, I don't know where this idea comes from, but like they have nervous systems.
Yeah.
They have eyes. Like, what do you think is going on with their eyes?
Yeah.
they're seeing things, with their eyes. They have experiences, So like the idea that they can't feel pain, I mean, it's just completely crazy. So, I've seen people scale fish alive because they're like, well, fish can't feel pain. And it's like, and actually this is kind of interesting. One time I was presenting just the idea of panpsychism to like a family friend. And she was like, she had a pretty unique reaction to it, which is that she was immediately attracted to it. Not usually how people react to panpsychism. She immediately thought it was cool, but she couldn't accept it because her religious views implied that it was okay to eat animals. And panpsychism would imply that it's not okay to eat animals in her mind. So I didn't say any of this, but that's just what she read it as. She was like, well, that actually sounds really plausible to me, but I can't accept it because it conflicts with my religious view that it's okay to eat animals. And if you're right about this, then it's not okay to eat animals. So that was a pretty strange reaction to panpsychism. But it does kind of like put a final bullet in the head of neo-Cartesianism, which is something that absolutely needs to die and does still exist in some forms.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of other ethical implications, I would say, like environmentalist implications. So if you do happen to think that states of consciousness are the only intrinsically valuable things in nature, which is a plausible view, then saying that, something like the earth has a state of consciousness, or saying that something like a river or a tree or whatever, now these things have intrinsic value and not just instrumental value. Whereas before, in like the kind of post-Cartesian world that we've been living in, it says that, these things are just mechanisms and whatever value they might have, it's all instrumental value. So if they're valuable to us, then yeah, they're valuable, but that's the only reason why. You don't actually have to like respect them on their own terms or anything. And, panpsychism seems to, kind of just erode that view. If you think that states of consciousness are valuable, let alone if you think they're the only valuable thing, intrinsically valuable thing. So now the natural world doesn't just have instrumental value to us, which has been the source of a lot of our destruction of the environment. It's like, well, we can just tear down entire forests if we need the lumber to build more like high-rise apartments or something like that. And if you view something like a forest as intrinsically valuable, then it's just not morally the same act anymore. Destroying a forest, if it's less like destroying a mechanism and building a new mechanism and more like killing an animal, then you have to have some kind of moral justification for that in a way that you don't if it's just, an insentient mechanism that only has instrumental value. So I think panpsychism could kind of imbue the natural world with intrinsic value and make us care more about the environment. Again, it's not that you can't destroy anything or change anything that has intrinsic value. Like we do that all the time, but it's just, you have to have a good reason for it, and you have to do it with a certain level of respect. It's not nothing, if you kill an animal, Like if you kill an animal, you have to have a pretty good reason to do it. It's not like kicking a rock or something. And when it comes to destroying a tree, well, on panpsychism, that's more like, you know, killing a fish or you know, something along those lines, you know. So I think it does give people a different attitude towards natural things and towards the environment, where it's more, all of their actions are more morally salient, I guess. And there has to be more of a justification. And I think it might bring about more of a feeling of like respect for the natural world, which we've been treating like it's an insentient mechanism that only has instrumental value basically for the last few hundred years. And you can kind of see where that's gotten us.
Yeah, thank you. And then you, so that helps us think more intrinsically about the value of things that we might otherwise have seen instrumental. And you avoid this sort of super flattening, everything matters, so nothing matters, because of this idea of grading and recognizing the fact that, you know, the consciousness that you have in your mind is not morally equivalent to the consciousness in a blade of grass. So you still allows that space to, you know, consider the moral weight in a different way too. And I don't know if this works, but something I explored when I talked to Luke Roloffs, you mentioned before, I know you've spoken to before as well, fascinating mind. And I found it really interesting because I come from a much more sort of boring philosophy of mind that just sees it as an evolved capacity that probably developed during the Cambrian or Precambrian era as a result of, you know, the adaptiveness of doing information processing that modeled the self, modeled the environment, and made us want to go towards good stuff and away from bad stuff. So in that sense, I see it as a, you know, a biologically evolved, so far really rich class of information processing, and it just happens to feel this way to run it. So, and many other sentientists disagree, as I know you will too. So
well, I actually just to interject, I totally agree with everything you just said. I just don't think there was an arbitrary cutoff where there was just total insentience. But yeah, obviously it did evolve these, like, you know, modeling the environment and being motivated in more and more complex ways. But I just think that sort of motivational force was kind of there at the bottom, you know. The way that you and I like go towards certain things and are averted from like negative stimuli, like I think it's the same kind of thing, just even on like a very small, like cellular or atomic level. So the same kind of thing that motivates you and me is the same kind of thing that motivates small particles, but there can be dramatic changes in complexity in that. And also, like you said, like, you know, modeling the environment, navigating a more complex, like, social reality. So I actually don't disagree with what you said. I just don't think there was like a cutoff where that stopped. Exactly.
Yeah. You think that essential kernel of awareness was actually predated that process, that evolutionary mm-hmm. process, and is much more prevalent. And that was one of the things that was interesting in my conversation with Luke, because he has a panpsychist view, and I'm sure you have different varieties of how you play that through. But we've both ended up in a very similar position ethically, both vegan, both have a sort of what you might call a teocentric stance. And what I was exploring with him was whether there's value in almost disconnecting the idea of sentience and consciousness, so that you could say, but there's one way in which I like the idea of sentience because it seems to me the morally salient component of consciousness. So a lot of people, when they're talking about consciousness, loads of extra stuff into it. They talk about, you know, advanced views of the self, the concept of self-identity, the ability to plan for the future, a certain level of sapience and cognition and blah, blah, blah. And I want to strip all that out and say, that's all very interesting. That's not what's morally salient. The morally salient thing is just the capacity to have an experience, particularly a valenced experience. So in that sense, I'm suggesting that sentience is a subset of this big, messy thing that people call consciousness, which they often define in ways that privilege us because that's what us humans love to do. But there's a different way of disconnecting the two, where you could actually say, if you have a panpsychist view, where you think that kernel of essential awareness is much more prevalent and predates the evolutionary process that led to animals, could that consciousness, you know, maybe a micro consciousness, actually be insentient? So there's a sense of where a particle or an electron or whatever it might be aware in some sense, but because it doesn't have, you know, any of the perceptual apparatus we do, and it doesn't have the information processing capacity we seem to have that seems to drive the valenced experience, maybe there's a sort of micro conscious something there as part of its essence, but it doesn't actually give it the capacity to suffer or to flourish. And I quite like that idea. I don't know if it works philosophically, but I quite like that idea, partly because I just can't get my head around what it would be like to be an electron, because it seems to be such a simple thing. I don't understand physically how any process could even operate. And you take it to the next level of a photon where time doesn't even pass for it. I can say, okay, if you want to define consciousness as something that's fundamentally essential and is part of that, I can sort of accord that, but I still can't imagine it really suffering or flourishing in a morally salient way. So that's another way I wonder if we can almost disconnect consciousness and sentience, so that maybe macro consciousnesses are sentient, but micro consciousnesses aren't. I don't know if that works.
Oops. No, I think we're in total agreement there, especially with the first part where, you know, consciousness is this very messy term that means, you know, 50 different things. And like, yeah, sentience, I feel like you're trying to hone in on what's actually morally relevant here. Yeah. So like, you know, I think it was John Stuart Mill who said, like, it's not whether it can reason. It's not whether it can engage in these like higher order functions. It's whether or not it can suffer.
Yeah. Bentham.
Like that's, yeah. Yeah. Oh, Bentham said that. Yeah. Yeah. One of those guys. So I think that that's the same kind of move where it's like, what exactly is morally relevant about consciousness? It's not really like complex information processing. Like my computer can do that, you know, but I don't think that my computer is conscious. And I don't think it's like morally relevant. Like that's something that does just have like instrumental value. So yeah, if you're just trying to identify like what's the morally salient aspect of consciousness, then yeah, sentience is like a good way of getting there. You know, like sentience sounds to me sort of like subjective experience, you know, like the thing that makes the hard problem hard, you know, whatever people are trying to get at with that term. You know, we're not talking about all the complex functions of human consciousness. We're not talking about all these higher order thoughts. You know, we're talking about something that's pretty simple, stripped down, and just gives something a positive or negative valence, like whatever that is. That's the morally relevant part. So yeah, if you want to call that sentience, then I'm totally with you. I tend to use sentience as kind of synonymous with subjective experience. But as long as you're clear about how you're defining the term, then yeah, that's totally fine. And I'd totally be with you. Because I think that I would say that if you took an electron and like flung it out into space, it would be sentient in the sense that it would be like something for it to exist. But an electron that's like a part of my right arm is not conscious. It's a part of a broader system. You know, it's been merged into this bigger whole. So it's not like anything to be that electron. But if you took one and like flung it out into space, then yeah, I think it would be like something. So I wouldn't have an issue with calling it sentient. But if you did stipulate that, like, no, by sentience, I mean like morally relevant forms of sentience, then I'd be like, oh yeah, well, it's insentient then. Yeah, I don't care about it.
But like, and there's a danger. I'm just sort of using circular definitions to get back to where I want to get to. But it feels like it sort of works to me because in a sense, mm-hmm. as we said earlier on, I guess there is this sense that morality, if it's anything, is about a concern for others and their perspective. And for that to bite, the other has to care about their own perspective. Mm-hmm. In that sense. So I can imagine an electron being minimally conscious, but in such a way that there's zero valence there. It doesn't, you know, there's some sense of awareness, but it doesn't really care about itself. Do you know what I mean?
It doesn't have self-consciousness. It wouldn't have any of this higher order stuff. It would just be this brute, what it's likeness that maybe there's some feeling of like kind of wanting to go towards these things with positive charge or something, but like it would be so dimly relatable to our experience at all. But electron, I mean, you've mentioned earlier that it's hard to imagine electrons being conscious because there's not much of a process going on there.
Yeah.
I would push back on that a little bit because electrons are not like these little tiny billiard balls or like grains of sand, like how we like ordinarily imagine them. They actually are kind of this like processual kind of fluctuating, you know, they're not really like objects. They're more, you know, processes. So it's easier to imagine.
And each
process,
one is potentially, you know, everywhere all the time.
I don't even try to bother with some of the physics stuff. It's too weird, but I mean, the other thing is panpsychists think that consciousness or, you know, sentience or subjective experience or what have you, just the, what it's likeness of like, you know, our inner lives, like, that is just kind of brute and fundamental. So you don't need any kind of process for it to be, you don't need like two particles interacting somehow to make that happen. It's just the raw material that's being worked with. So there doesn't have to be some kind of process and then it emerges from this process. Like it just is the stuff that's doing the processing. Like it is the stuff that's undergoing all those processes. So you don't get it from something more fundamental. You just start with it and then, like, you know, so it, I can see how intuitively, though, if you're just picturing like a little electron grain of sand that's just not doing anything, it's like, well, how is it like anything to be? Like, I feel that same intuition, but I'm just saying I think of things, A, more as processes instead of like static objects, and B, you know, sentience is supposed to be, you know, I should specify, like, you know, morally irrelevant sentience is, you know, kind of the basis, like it's sort of the, it's at the foundation of reality on panpsychism. Like consciousness is fundamental on panpsychism. It doesn't like come out of anything. It doesn't like emerge from any process. Like you get more complex forms of consciousness out of this more basic form of consciousness.
Yeah, thank you. And I think in a way there's, without doing a deep dive into panpsychism that I'm unqualified for, there's one sort of emotional route I think some people find to panpsychism, which is something like, you know, my own consciousness is the thing I'm most confident exists. It feels like, and I don't understand how it could be purely a matter of the physical process that's gone in my mind. It feels like my intuition and maybe my philosophizing leads me to believe it is distinct from those things in some way. And because I can't understand why it would come about from the physical process that's going on in my mind, there's a sort of process of then assuming it must be fundamental because it must have come from somewhere. So I don't find that path, there's no real pull there, because it feels like another example of the sort of Copernican human logic of just assuming that we and things about us and our consciousness must be central or fundamental to everything because we're so amazing. So I don't feel the emotional pull of that. But at the same time, there's a path towards panpsychism that I am much more drawn to, because in a sense, my view is that sentience and also consciousness, but particularly sentience, is just a class of information processing. And if it is just a class of information processing, as you were saying earlier on, okay, well, where does that start? So I think there is something distinctive about the Precambrian and the evolutionary process that gave rise to sentience. But if you want to describe what's going on in those sentient beings in purely mechanistic terms as patterns of information processing, then there was information processing going on long before the Precambrian. And, you know, in a funny sense, an electron in its broadest sense is doing some sort of information processing.
I
don't see a qualitative difference between what's going on in my head and what's going on in, you know, this coffee mug, in a sense, you know, there's electrons buzzing and quarks doing their shit. You know, there's, so that's a different path that maybe makes me, you know, I can see that attraction more, that there isn't some magical difference. So maybe we are part of a continuum, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it brings a lot of people in that direction, is like, yeah, there's not a fundamental difference. There's nothing magical about me. Like, I'm just a bunch of physical processes that are, you know, I'm just a collection of physical activity.
Yeah. And yeah, it's almost as if there's an arrogant path to panpsychism, but then there's a super humble path to panpsychism.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the one I relate to more. That's why it always cracks me up when people say that, like, yeah, panpsychism is kind of anthropocentric. I'm like, I feel like it's the least possible anthropocentric view.
We're really, it's not like, special.
You have really been underestimating how not special we are. But it's like, there's no real distinction between the kind of physical activity. You know, it's just protons, neutrons, and electrons here. You know, they're just arranged in a funny way because of evolutionary history. Like if you were saying, like, you know, you specified earlier, like, that it's a special kind of information processing that leads to consciousness. And you have to add that, because if you didn't, then you would just default be a panpsychist. You say, like, oh, if it's just information processing, well, that's happening everywhere. Yeah. Like, you know,
And that's partly where my slightly, and you picked me up on this, my slightly cheeky analog to PowerPointism came into play, because in a sense, I was saying, you know, PowerPoint is just one type of information processing, but that doesn't mean all the information processing is PowerPoint. In the same way as I see consciousness as a class of information processing, but that doesn't mean all information processing is. So I guess that's where I'd slightly cheekily draw. And part of it comes back to, as you were saying, the terms and the usage. What, you know, what do we mean by these words in the first place?
Right. Yeah. I mean, for me, it just comes back to the hard problem where you can get PowerPoint from non-PowerPoint. Like, you can get human beings from non-human beings. Like, you can exhaustively describe human beings in physical terms. And, you know, there's nothing left over except for our subjective experiences. Like, that just seems like you can't really, you know, if you say, how do you get human beings from things that are not human, then you can like tell an evolutionary story and it doesn't seem like anything's really left over. You know, like it's totally fine to get human beings from non-human beings. It's totally fine to get life from non-life. But when you're talking about getting subjective experiences from a point of view, like the ones that I'm directly acquainted with right now, you're talking about getting subjective experiences from non-subjectivity. That's when it just seems like you're starting with the wrong kind of thing. You know, so it's like you can get PowerPoint from non-PowerPoint. You can get things that are nifty from things that aren't nifty.
Yeah.
So like your PowerPoint objection is exactly Dan Dennett's like big objection to
niftyism. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, everything is nifty. A better point of his objection there is that panpsychism wouldn't seem to change anything. Like, what does it really change anything to say everything is nifty? He's like, well, what is it? How does it change anything to say everything is conscious? Well, I mean, obviously we don't say everything is conscious. And obviously we've been talking about some of the implications panpsychism might have, but still it's worth saying, what difference does this difference make? You know, like, so, okay, so panpsychism is true. So what, like what follows from that? Well, solving the hard problem, I think, is not nothing, but like, you know, the main thing that pulls me to panpsychism, because the stuff we're talking about earlier about how there's no fundamental difference between me and the tree outside my window in like physical terms, like it's just, I'm just the same material that's been arranged differently. Yeah, that intuitively makes sense to me. But the reason I became a panpsychist is more the hard problem, like, or what Josh Rasmussen has taken to calling the construction problem of like, you start with this physical stuff over here that can be exhaustively described quantitatively. Nothing is left out. And then you just put that together in the right way. And eventually you get subjective experiences from a point of view. That's just the wrong kind of stuff to be working with to get from that to that. It's like starting with, you know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and trying to get to like the planet Neptune or something. It's like, oh, well, Neptune is just Beethoven's Ninth Symphony arranged Neptune wise. It's like, no, it's not. I can't even really identify why it's not. It's just, that's the wrong kind of thing.
And I think that's the absolute heart of it, isn't it? Is if you think through that process of building up to a human, what's left over is subjective awareness, then you have the hard problem. And I guess my amateur stance is I'm not sure anything's left over. I think subjective awareness is just a characteristic of, you know, what it's like to run this sort of information processing. And in that sense, you know, our internal reports of our own consciousness, I don't see as radically different from the reports I might get from someone else about theirs. And I could imagine a situation where you might even be able to run a sort of bat emulator that would actually give me, or an Emerson emulator that would give me temporarily the experience of what it's really like to be like you. And I do think that, you know, once you've, the information processing is a complete and exhaustive, but that's deeply unconvincing to someone who just doesn't see how that can capture what we're experiencing now as we talk to each other. Yeah, that's the heart of it, I guess.
It does sound like, you know, well, you can just start with it with, you know, bananas and put them together in the right way and you'll get metaethics. And, you know, like, that's just what it sounds like to me. like, oh, well, I can see how this happens. And it's like, okay, if you can see how this happens, then what you should be able to do is draw out an intelligible bridge between the quantitative and the qualitative, like a stepwise process where you start with things that can be exhaustively described quantitatively, you know, so purely in the realm of physical science and like fundamental physics. And you start with those raw materials and you just kind of put them together in such a way where you intelligibly get a stepwise progression until suddenly, or not suddenly, it's like something for me from a point of view. You know, and that just, no physicalist has ever done that. Most physicalists don't even try. They just say they don't have to. You know, they try to explain why they shouldn't have to do that. But if it's nothing but quantitative stuff, then you should be able to draw an intelligible bridge from that to qualitative experiences.
Yeah. And we could do another 2 hours on this as well, because I think I will let you go in a minute. But I think there's a sense that I also wonder if we're applying a different approach to when we think about consciousness scientifically to other stuff. So, because in a way, one of the criticisms of the science of consciousness is the one thing you're not addressing is the subjective experience, right? You look at the neurons firing, you look at the information processing, you're looking at the behavior and you're looking at the perception and blah, blah, blah. But you're not addressing the qualitative stuff. And some people will say, well, you know, we don't have the tools. That's not what science does, but we're working on what we can work on. Other people will say that qualitative stuff doesn't meaningfully exist. And once we've done enough on the quantitative side, you'll see that, right? It will be like, you know, the idea of a life essence or something, the idea will just become irrelevant. But there are, there's another related view, which is, I wonder if we have that problem everywhere with all of our epistemology, because when we're doing classical physics about electrons and quarks, we're not really getting to the essence of what those things are. We're studying behavior and the things we can quantify about them. And, you know, so in a sense, in the same way as we're studying consciousness, we're not, you know, are we really getting to the essence of it? I'm not sure we're getting to the essence of any reality. We're just stumbling around doing what we can using evidence. So on that, on one hand, I'd say maybe that disarms this challenge about consciousness, because it's just like anything else, right? We're just trying to understand it, and what can we do but use the quantitative? And I think the panpsychist would say, yeah, and the essence of the electron and the essence of the consciousness are the same thing, right? So
everything you're saying makes perfect sense to me, where it's like, no, look, this is just normal science. Like, all of physical science is just dealing with what stuff does and not what stuff is. We're not really getting at what things are in themselves when we're doing physical science. We're just talking about structure and behavior. And the thing is, like, that is the foundation of modern panpsychism. Like, that first move, like that, like, Russellian monist move. You know, so like Bertrand Russell and Arthur Eddington, like, they wrote books that basically, I mean, you basically just summarized what the point they were trying to make, where they're like, this is what physical science does. It's not in the business of telling us what things actually are, but they try to argue there must be like a thing in itself. They're, like, things must have an intrinsic nature that physical science is incapable of actually telling us about, because it doesn't matter to physical science, but it's still there. And there are at least two good reasons for thinking that there is an intrinsic nature to physical stuff. One is kind of an abstract argument, and the second is just that consciousness exists. And like, so like, you know, so if you try to do a purely behavioristic approach to human psychology, where you say the science of psychology is ultimately about behavior, you know, human behavior, the behavior of their brains, verbal behavior, the only thing we can get at scientifically is behavior. But it's clearly crazy to go from that to saying there is no consciousness, because the only thing we can publicly observe is physical behavior. Like, I agree, the only thing we can publicly observe is physical behavior and not consciousness. But we know, because we're conscious, we know that consciousness exists. So physical science is just inadequate. Physical science can't tell us what things are in themselves. And then we have to, like, do philosophy to figure out what the nature of things in themselves, you know, what it actually is. We know what it is in our case, it's consciousness.
Yeah, and there's, I guess that's another break point, which is our subjective experience that essence? Or is it just another set of reports and behavior?
I am in essence a mental being. Like, yeah. I mean, that's why Descartes, you know, he kind of had a point where he was saying, like, I can doubt the existence of my physical being, but I can't doubt the existence of my mind. I think, therefore, like, that's what you are in essence. You are a mental being in essence. So it makes sense to me to say that, like, yeah, the intrinsic nature of this physical stuff is consciousness. That's what it is in essence. Like, that's what it is in itself. And then it kind of appears to us as physical. We can make these even more abstract physical models that describe its behavior, but that's not what the thing actually is.
Yeah.
And physicalists are, like, taking this highly abstract thing that physical science gives us and saying, oh, I can put this together and get consciousness. Like, no, you can't. Like, you never will. It's just like, yeah, you're starting from, like, a weird philosophical position, but it sounds defensible, because what you're saying is like, oh, I think science can figure this out. And that's pretty much always a reasonable thing to say, you know, but in this context, I think it's not, for, like, in principle reasons.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, that was a fascinating exploration. And I think we can agree, and I think Luke Roelofs would as well, is that whatever sentience is, it matters. So
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
We can still share that platform. So. And I think you're right. There's still a lot of synergy and overlap between these different ways of thinking, even if we might still have a different sort of sense about where they ultimately lie. But yeah, that's fascinating.
No, I'm happy to be here. And, you know, I could talk to you all day. But it has been interesting to see the areas of overlap, because I just assumed that we wouldn't have some of the same opinions, like, for instance, about the Russellian monist stuff that you were outlining there a moment ago about, like, the role of physical science. And just like, yeah, man, like, you sound like Philip Goff right now. Like,
no, it's fascinating to explore. And I think you're right. There's some commonalities there. We'll see. I need to keep reading. Yeah. But before I let you go, I wanted to finish with another super crazily big question, which is, how do we make a better future? Now, it's obvious that from your work and my work that we think that podcasting and YouTubing will make the world a better place. But how do you think about driving positive change, the potential for a better future, in the context that we've set in part of this conversation, where, as we said earlier on, you know, we have these really powerful established social norms that are slow to change, that seem to absolutely diametrically clash with a naturalistic and a sentientist sort of ethic. And I guess part of the reason I've been doing this work is because intuitively it feels that if we want to make the world better, whether we like it or not, humans have most of the power at the moment, particularly on this planet. And every human decision is driven by their worldview, whether that's implicit or explicit. And the most important things about worldviews, to my mind, are, you know, the things we've been talking about. You know, how do you choose what to believe and what matters ethically? And that almost every human caused problem seems to be driven either by a failure of compassion, because we've excluded some victim entity from our compassion, we just decided we don't care, or some epistemological error, we've just got something really horribly wrong. So this idea of trying to establish a baseline for, at least let's take a naturalistic approach and a sentientist approach together, maybe is a better baseline for us. But given all we've talked about, how do you think about the future and how and whether we can make a better one?
I'm actually pretty pessimistic about the future. I don't really expect any good thing to happen in my lifetime politically. I really just don't think there's much of a good future for humanity. But there are a couple bright spots. Like we touched on one of them, which is that I think there actually could be an end to factory farming. Like I think that really could happen. Like before we die, I think we could see factory farming banned, and not in a way where there's going to be this huge backlash and reaction, which is what would happen now if you tried to do it. But like I think that, you know, sort of fake meat products, lab-grown meat, whatever, I think it'll advance and get cheaper and cheaper. And eventually it will be as good, if not better. It'll also probably be healthier in some ways, but it doesn't have to be. But you could have something that's identical in terms of like taste and consistency, and it will be cheaper eventually than the factory farm meat because it's just more efficient. It just seems like a priori. It seems like it would be cheaper eventually because you don't have to raise an entire animal and feed it and, you know, and then just kill it and then take the part that you want. You can just grow the part that you want. So once you figure out how to do that, it seems like it would be cheaper. And then just, you know, normal, like we live in like a semi-capitalist system. So it's like, you know, the market really does determine quite a lot. It's part of why we have better meat products now, is because of, you know, kind of market forces that push it in that direction. So it actually does matter if you abstain from like, you know, fast food and factory farming and all that stuff. Like it actually does have an impact. Your consumption does matter. It's not the most important thing. It's not like the only thing that matters, but it does have some kind of impact.
Yeah. We're where most of the money comes from. Yeah. Apart from the subsidies. Yeah.
So I think that we actually could get rid of factory farming because there will be a competing set of products that are better and cheaper, and it will diminish, you know, the need for factory farming, and it'll get to the point where it's not as prevalent as it is now, and it will actually be feasible to ban it. And there will be a small group of psychotics who want to eat animal products anyway, even though there are other alternatives that are like literally indistinguishable, because they're not good people and because they would rather, they're like, I don't want to eat meat if it doesn't come from a tortured cow. You know, it's like there are some people who are like that, but I think they actually are a minority. So I think that, you know, things will actually be, I think there actually is some like hope for, you know, banning factory farming eventually, but only once there are alternatives that could replace it. Because the fact is, people are not going to part with their little treats, you know, and all the moral, you know, like artifice around it. It's all just bullshit. Like they just like their little treats. They just clap their hands together and they just want their fast food and stuff. And like, look, I get it. Like it's an escape from like a miserable job or life or so. It can be a bright spot. It can be like a nice indulgence, I guess. And it's hard to think about like the consequences of, you know, of like where this stuff actually came from.
Yeah. And it has cultural and social resonance as well, and identity resonance for a lot of people. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but I think it actually is possible to get rid of it, but not until there are alternatives that are just as good and probably cheaper. Because even if they're just as good, but they're the same price, I think people will just kind of almost absentmindedly pick the real stuff. Yeah, so it's got to be cheaper. It's got to be just as good. But I think that's actually possible. You know,
yeah,
so
like it's feasible. Yeah.
So we could actually see an end to factory farming, which is one of the worst things about our society present day. So one of the worst things about our culture could come to an end. So that's like one of the best things I could mention, I guess. Secondly, I think that union activity is a positive sign. Like, there's been all this positive union development and activity that just was completely dead for like decades. And that's probably one of the only positive political developments that I've seen like in my adult life. And that seems to be going okay. Like, I'm kind of cautiously optimistic about that. But yeah, I mean, ideally we would have a more democratic economy overall, with workers having more like ownership and control over capital goods and the means of production. But I don't really see that happening, even though I think it would be better. But the one bright spot there, I think, is that union activity. So I could see how it could all go very wrong. Like, I could see how they could be kind of captured by the same forces that they're opposed to. But it might go well. I don't know. It's a source of optimism.
The power a little bit, at least. Yeah.
Potential. Yeah. I mean, I could see it also going horribly wrong, but it might also work out. So, like, I'm very, you know, pro union, and there seems to be some positive developments in that realm. So those are the two nice things I have to say. I don't have much else to say in terms of a better future. Yeah, every other development seems negative, but what are you going to do? Maybe I'll be pleasantly surprised.
Maybe. And as a closing question, to what degree do you think philosophy, like the work you're doing, does have ripples that can be positive across the world? Is it something you're doing just because you find it interesting, or do you think it can actually make a difference when someone, you know, watches your YouTube video? And
I really don't think that what I'm doing is important, but I think what you're doing is important. I don't think what I'm doing is that important. I'm just talking about like abstract philosophical questions. I'm not sure if they even matter. They just, it's like, maybe I'm just like playing Sudoku in like a really like, you know, like high level way or something. Like, maybe that's all I'm doing. But I find it interesting, and I can't help but think about things like the hard problem of consciousness. Like, it will bother me, even if I just try to stop and just try to quit and just do things that are like practically useful to other people. I'm going to end up thinking about like different models of God and, the hard problem of consciousness. Like, it's just unavoidable. And people do seem to value it. Like, they do seem to, like, I think these are really deeply important questions. They just don't seem that practical to me. Like, a lot of people do care about whether God exists, and it's a very important question, you know, and that does have practical implications. But the kind of stuff that I'm talking about, I don't know if it has a lot of practical impact. My time would probably be better spent, like, you know, working for an effective altruist charity, or like, if I'm going to podcast, and podcasting about like animal rights or something that would actually help people.
I wouldn't play it down too much, because I think that the work you do is helping people understand naturalistic epistemology and naturalistically grounded ethics. Both are things that I think are deeply important. But the other thing that I think I've been really impressed by with your work is your intellectual honesty and your willingness to follow your thought to where it needs to go, and the humility and the compassion with which you engage with others who virulently disagree with you. And I've heard many of the theists you talk to say, you know, you're one of the only counter-apologetics type people I can actually enjoy a conversation with, because they know that you're not trying to beat them over the head with something, or even in your debates, you're not necessarily just trying to win. You know, you genuinely care and are really interested. And I think just setting that example is enormously powerful. And the final thing you're definitely doing of value is you're talking to your audience in the world instead of your wife. So there's a win there for her, at least.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all that. And yeah, if nothing else, I've improved the quality of my wife's daily life. She still can't escape from me totally. She still gets some. Because sometimes people are surprised where they'll be like, oh, what did your wife think about that? I'm like, she doesn't listen to my podcast. And it's just like, she doesn't. I'm like, she gets 3 personal podcasts a day. Like, she can't handle much more.
Yeah. Whether she likes it or not. And there's no unsubscribe button. Yeah.
Yeah. The unsubscribe button is a divorce.
And like, even she never reaches for that.
But yeah, no, thank you for saying all that though. I really do appreciate it. That's very nice to hear. I do try to be, you know, intellectually honest, and, I guess I should just take yes for an answer. I'll just say thank you for the compliment. Thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Inspiration. I've learned a lot, as ever, too, from your work and from the conversation. It's great to talk real time instead of it just being me listening to you. So thank you so much for making the time. What's the best way of people following you and learning about your work. I'll include the links in the show notes, of course, to Counter Apologetics and Walden Pod. But
yeah, no, I mean, I've got a link tree that's in my Twitter bio. It's in most of the descriptions of the YouTube videos and stuff. But yeah, I'm on YouTube as Emerson Green. Like I said, everything is kind of decentralized, but I've got the YouTube channel where most of the podcasts end up, most of them. I've got Counter Apologetics and I've got Walden Pod. Those are two pods. So if you'd rather listen on like iTunes or Spotify, then that's where you go, Counter Apologetics or Walden Pod. And if you prefer YouTube, then yeah, it's just Emerson Green. But yeah, it's religion, consciousness, sometimes biology, sometimes other stuff. You know, I had an episode about socialism a while back, where I gave my kind of like naive, like Noam Chomsky style defense of it with my friend Micah Edvinson. But yeah, I mean, it's mostly religion and it's mostly consciousness. So, but yeah, that's where they can find me. And I'm on Twitter at Walden Pod.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, I will let you get on with the rest of your day. Thanks to your wife for lending you to me too. Yeah. Take care. Yeah. And please stay in touch.
No, thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Emerson.